Hello, is this on? Welcome to the long-awaited top 100 films stream. It is me, the academic agent. If you're just some kind of random person stumbling along YouTube who's just happened to find this list, I'm usually a politics channel, but I'm currently running what I'm calling my non-politics week. And so on this stream, I will be counting down my top 100 films. And I should be clear what sort of list this is. It's not, these aren't my picks for the best 100 films of all time, because, well, objectively speaking, that list would look quite close to something like the Sight and Sound Top 100 or the BFI Top 100 or the AFI Top 100. So you don't need me, for example, to tell you that Citizen Kane is a really good film. Rather, this is a list of my 100. People are saying there is boomer sound. What's wrong with the audio? What's wrong with the audio? Is that better? Is that better now? Hello? Any good? Tell me if the audio is any better. I'm just having a look at the audio. Yeah, tell me. Is it good? Better? Yes. Some people are still saying it's tinny audio. Do you know what? These sorts of things are very irritating to me. Sound like I'm in a tunnel. I think it's because my mic is my thing is picking up my is not picking up my actual mic, but is picking up the internal mic. So let me try fiddling around with a couple of things. Right. How's that? God's sake. It's interrupted my professional. All right, I tell you what the issue is. I need to put my headphones in, I reckon. It's picking up like actual. The problem is not the mic, the problem is the room. So let me see. Hold on. Right, is this any better? God's sake, is it any better? Tell me. It's already taken me about 3 hours to get to the point of starting this stream. Any better? Any better? Right. Okay. Anybody else says boomer audio, I'm going to kick them out. Okay, so what I'm doing here, I'm counting down my top 100 films. They're my top 100 personal favorite films. And the screen grab is a little bit misleading because it makes it sound like I'm going to talk about Toy Story and by the Indiana Jones and the E.T. and things like this. I can already reveal that there's not going to be many kind of uber mainstream films of that nature on the list. What I've done, I have made up this snazzy PDF. And my aim, hopefully everybody can see that. Can you all see this PDF? Yep, you can all see the PDF. Tell me, can you see me? All right. So this, no matter what happens, this list is not going to be like any other. One thing I can guarantee it won't be like any other list on the internet that as it currently exists. No other top 100 looks like this. I've got a number of interesting criteria here. So you can see I've broken down the top 100 by genre. There is no superhero movies on the list, I discovered. There was only one list film that would have even been in contention, and that was Christopher Nolan's Dark Knight. But I've decided that time is actually, I don't know, it's just not top 100 worthy in my view. So it was a good movie, but there were 100 films I wanted to have on the list more. And essentially what I did is I tried to do a comparison of, like, if I was on a desert island, which of these films could I live without and which ones would I definitely want with me? And on that basis, that's how I picked the list, basically. So I did I held the two movies together, and I was like, if it was between this and this, what would it be? And then I went to the next one and the next one, and that's how I came up with the entire 100. Placements actually surprised me a little bit, but I wanted it to be an absolutely honest reflection of my tastes. Now, I will say I've been a film fan for a very long time. I was an obsessive kind of cinephile or film buff for quite a long time before talking here on YouTube, and I have probably seen more films than the average person, although there are gaps in my viewing, as there is for everyone else's. One thing I will say at the outset is that you will see that I have certain tastes, certain things that I like, and certain things that I tend not to like. So, for example, there is no there's no like French New Wave films on this. I don't like films which have extremely slow, ponderous, ponderous shots which just kind of linger. I understand why the Sight and Sound types like that sort of film, where it's all about the mise-en-scene and how it looks within the frame and all this sort of stuff. But that I'm looking for other things out of my movies, and hopefully some patterns will emerge as we go forward. So let's move on a little bit. And yep. So you can see, of the films, there are 67 one-shots directors with only one film in the list, eight films with two, eight directors who have two films, sorry, yes, eight directors who have two films apiece. There are three directors who have three films. There is only one director who has four films, and there is one director who has five films in the list. Okay. So let's keep on going. I'm just kind of teasing the audience here as people are coming in. Now, here is my country of origin. This is this is where the films were made. Quite a lot of American films, as you can imagine. 50 were made in the USA. I think 22 were made in the UK, 22 British movies, 12 were directly made kind of jointly between the USA and the UK, and then you can see the distribution of some of the rest there. So even though I am a fan of world cinema and of films of different languages and things like this, you can see I haven't picked loads of that Renoir is not on the list, for example, or Truffaut or any 400 Blows or any of this sort of thing. And I also have stayed away from things like Spirit of the Beehive. And this is what I would call real film buffs. They love this sort of very visual continental type of film. And as you can see, well, as we'll get on to, I'm looking for different things. So let's have a look then at number 100. Now, this was a very late entrance onto the list. I actually watched it two nights ago. And it's a comedy film from the late 90s, an American film, where these two gentlemen that you can see here, the setup is the guy on the left is called Chad, and the guy on the right is called Howard. Howard is ostensibly Chad's boss in this kind of soulless corporation they work for, but Chad is quite an alpha male. And essentially, as the film starts, I don't want to give away too many spoilers, but the setup of the film, I'll explain. Both Howard and Chad, their love interest, their women left them at the start of the film. And so Chad says, listen, I'm sick of all these women screwing us over all the time. Why don't we find a really vulnerable woman? And basically, we will both, you know, date them, you know, lay out all the starts, try to make this woman fall in love with us. And then when she least expect it, we will both pull the plug at the same time and kind of break her spirit and watch her cry. That is the setup for the entire film. And it is relentlessly dark. I mean, it's ostensibly a comedy, but it's we just watch these two men try to enact this plan that Chad has got. And to make matters worse, the woman that they end up finding is deaf, and she can't speak properly. And you know, Chad makes fun of her. He says that she sounds like a dolphin. He calls her a retard and all this sort of stuff. Chad is probably one of the most relentlessly dark and evil characters you will ever find in a film. And I'm actually surprised that it hasn't become, you know, a massive hit with like the MGTOW crowd. That's what I imagine would really enjoy a film like this. But I liked it for its unflinching look at the character of evil. I mean, there's a horrible scene in the film where Chad is just sitting in this office, and there's this young recruit who comes, a young black guy who works there. And Chad's just like, listen, you need balls to get ahead in this game. You need balls. So let's see them. And this young guy is kind of like, what do you mean? He's like, let's see them. And basically, he basically makes this guy end up getting his balls out so he can look at it. It's very unusual. But yes, In the Company of Men, a late entrant and a film that I find it very hard to track down. It doesn't seem like anywhere in the UK is selling this. And I ended up having to go through my university library account to watch this in the end through the library. But I would recommend tracking this film down and watching it. It's so dark. And, you know, some people will know about the internet meme, you know, the Chad and the Virgin. I mean, this is basically the Chad and the Virgin as a film. And I'm wondering if the originator of that meme was basing it on the Chad in this film, because he is, I mean, he's horrible, absolutely horrible. Yeah, so that's my number 100. Number 99 is The Purple Rose of Cairo. The only Woody Allen film that made it to my list. Actually, that's not true. I think there's another one there as well. I really like this film because it's about this woman who's got a really bad relationship with her husband. He you know, he beats her up, and the scenes of like domestic violence are quite visceral in the film. To escape from living with this horrible guy that she's with, she goes to the cinema. She goes and sits alone in the cinema and watches movies. And it's kind of quite, if you're really into films, the whole experience and ritual of going to the cinema in itself is kind of a nice thing, and the film captures that quite well. But then basically what happens, she's watching this film, and one of the characters in the movie starts to like notice her in the, and they start like interacting through the film. And eventually, as you can see here, the guy who is a character in the movie comes out of the film and starts to live kind of in the real world, and they start to have a relationship. But then there's a problem, because this starts to happen in different kind of iterations of this movie screening, and it's causing chaos both within the world of the film and in the real world. So I don't know. It's a very clear, it's kind of high concept comedy. You know, people can take or leave Woody Allen, but this is definitely one of his more interesting films, and especially one if you're a real fan of going to the cinema. Number 98 is La Haine, or The Hate, a French film. I think actually the only French film on this list, from the mid-90s. And it's set in this like really run-down council estate. I mean, I guess I don't know what they call them in France, but it's like a, you know, social housing project. It's like a big tower block, and you have all these people from different races and from different backgrounds, all trying to coexist in this around this kind of concrete jungle. And it's like a tinderbox, you know, the racial tensions, the social tensions. One of the, I mean, it's such a gritty, hard-hitting film. It was kind of a big, you know, like a critical hit at the time, I think, in the mid-90s there. But kind of interesting from a political point of view, watching that film. You know, that was 1995. I can only imagine what the situation in some of those places in France is now. So, yeah, Le Haine. And people sending super chats and things. What I'm going to do is I'm going to, I can see the live chat. I've learned from my mistakes. I've got the iPad open, so I can see normal comments. But in terms of reading super chats, I'll stop after every 10, read the super chats, and then I'll do it like that. Otherwise, we're never going to get through this list. All right. So number 98, Le Haine. Very good film. If anybody's seen any of these movies, you know, this is the sort of thing that you can tell me about. If you haven't, this is the whole point of the list. You can check them out maybe see if you can appreciate why I like them so much. So Le Haine, very good film. And a very, very honest, kind of unflinching film as well, which I actually wonder I sometimes wonder if a film like this would be made today in the current climate, where I'd imagine the issues have got a lot worse since 1995 in a place like France. So yeah, and in fact, whenever I think of France, this movie has such an impact on me that whenever I think of, you know, social and political issues in places like Paris, I think of this film first and foremost. So let's keep on going. Number 97 is Drive, the Nicholas Winding Refn movie, starring kind of Iceman Ryan Gosling. I actually watched this last night because I wasn't sure whether I should include it or not. I told the story on Twitter that I saw this with one of my best buddies. He'd come over and we went to the cinema and we watched Drive together. And it was a pretty busy cinema. And from about an hour in to the end of the film, so for, I'd say the last half hour of the movie, we were both almost in tears, laughing at the gratuitous and incredible acts of violence that happened in this film. Now, I'm not sure if it's meant to be funny, but we found it, I mean, it just kind of hit, just kind of struck a funny bone with us on that occasion. And one of the reasons is that the shifts of tone and violence in this film are very sudden, and they're very kind of random. But there are other reasons to like this film as well. The whole aesthetic, I mean, I was talking to some people on Twitter about this last night. The you know, that whole like synthwave Outrun kind of vibe. I think Drive probably was the big kind of cultural moment that maybe started all of that, the soundtrack with all of that kind of heavy 80s synth, his look. He wears this kind of leather jacket with a scorpion on the back. He's got these leather gloves. There's a amazing scene at one point where he just points in this incredibly unnatural and stilted manner at this woman. He's like, you know, kind of threatening her with this leather glove. Yeah. So Drive, cool movie. It's also, having only watched it last night, you know, it's probably the third time I watched it last night. It's quite short, you know, it's only 90 minutes long. And it's nice sometimes just to have a film that's done and dusted in an hour and a half. And yeah, it's cool. Very good film. So Drive. Now, I did go through a whole period where I thought Drive was probably a terrible film. And that probably is still... The jury's still out on like how good it actually is, but I really enjoy the kind of, it's a case of style over substance sometimes, and you know, just kind of immerse yourself in the glossy surfaces of the thing. And also, like, Ryan Gosling is this is a very different type of masculine character. I mean, he's almost doesn't talk very much, almost like autistic at times. But it's interesting seeing that put on screen. Yes. He reminded me at times last night, actually, of, you know, sometimes when you play an RPG like Zelda or something and the character doesn't talk, he's a bit like that as well. You know, there are several moments where other people try to say something to him and he just looks at them, doesn't talk. I kind of like that as well. Makes for, I don't know, something strangely stilted and awkward about the whole thing, which I like. So let's keep on going on. Number 96, Straw Dogs, directed by Sam Peckinpah, 1971. One of the reasons I like this film, I mean, this is an incredibly dark film, I'd say. Dustin Hoffman's character is, I can't remember, he's like a maths professor or a maths teacher or something like that. But he's essentially like your stereotypical American liberal. He's like a New York Democrat, you know, and he's got all of those socially progressive views, shall we say. And they move to England and they settle down in this, I can't remember whether they're in Devon or somewhere. Ruba in the chat will remember probably where they settle down. Basically what happens is over the course of this film, several things happen to this guy that causes him to question all of his previous liberal assumptions. And by the end of the film, he breaks, and you can see him here grabbing the gun. Now, one of the things that Straw Dogs is very famous for, and one of the reasons in this list, now, I don't condone any of this, obviously, but I just find it interesting, is that there's a rape scene in the film in which, and this is not too much of a spoiler, because I think it probably even says it on the back of the DVD, you know, it's that famous. His wife in the film is raped. But in the way that it's acted and the way it's shot and the way it's depicted in the film, there's this kind of huddle, there's this hint, there's a suggestion that she actually enjoys the rape, which is obviously very problematic, as leftists would say, for all sorts of reasons. But it's this kind of, we see this guy really like, all his fundamental beliefs are shot up by the hard reality of what's happening. And then there's this kind of extra element in with the mix. So I like Straw Dogs. I like its brutality. I like its unflinchingness. And I like the fact that it's the sort of film that I'd imagine has been, I can't imagine a modern Guardian critic enjoying Straw Dogs. They probably say it's reactionary or, you know, but bad for some reason. And films like that, I think, probably get under the skin in a way that more politically correct fare do not. So Straw Dogs. Yes, I would strongly recommend that one. Number 95 is Sideways, comedy from early 2000s. Now, what I like about this film is its bleak tone. There's this guy, he really likes wine, and I seem to remember that he's been storing this wine that he wants to drink all the way through the film, and they go on this like a kind of buddy movie, and you know, but it's got scenes of unbelievable darkness strewn in. I remember there's one scene where there's this actual cuckoldry goes on, where this guy's wife is getting banged, and you know, you hear him say, oh yeah, you love it, don't you, you know, all this sort of stuff. Really, really, you know, for a film that was fairly mainstream in 2004, I'd say it was, you know, it would have been on in magazines and things back then, and reviewed in all the usual places, and maybe even given a couple of awards or nominations. Sideways got to places that you don't often see. So it's kind of like a sleeper. I also really like the kind of somber, the kind of bittersweet, almost kind of devastating ending of the film, which is so, I mean, I don't want to give away any spoilers, but so Sideways is here for all of that. I like it. I like the fact that it goes to places that a lot of other films wouldn't go. And I like the fact that we're seeing this guy's kind of black internal misery, but at the same time, there's also this kind of sheen that all of his problems are completely first world, self-indulgent, you know, middle class. They're not like, so he's got problems, but they're also these kind of first world things, but you still feel them as well. So
yeah, I like Sideways for all of those reasons.
Let's keep on going. Number 94, 10 Rillingdon Place. This is a thriller that looks at a famous real-life serial killer, starring Richard Attenborough. For the people who know Richard Attenborough from other films, later in life, he was Santa Claus, and he was, was he a scientist or something in Jurassic Park? I seem to remember. This film will come as a shock because Richard Attenborough is terrifying as this kind of quiet serial killer. One of the things I really like about it is that you get a kind of sense of the mundane. This guy seems like a boring, normal guy, you know, yet he's also this obsessive, sick serial killer. And there's not many films, I think, that get inside the mind. I seem to recall there's a film called The Vanishing from the late 80s. It's not on the list, but that's one of the few other ones that gets to this. But I really like Richard Attenborough's performance in 10 Rillingdon Place. It's the sort of thing that if you caught it on like BBC Two at 11 p.m., for some reason they were showing this, you'd be very surprised at how good this was. So yes, 10 Rillingdon Place. That director, by the way, Richard Fleischer, he has got a kind of low-key great career. I haven't got any of his other movies on the list, but let me just run through some of the stuff he's done. He's done Dr. Doolittle, Soylent Green. I mean, just an interesting guy you don't hear much about, who really had quite a lot of good movies under his belt. 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea was another one of his. Let me keep on going, because number 93 is this film here, Heat. Now, I haven't put Heat here because I think it's necessarily a good film. Probably it's not a very good film. All of the talk in Heat is about this showdown between Robert De Niro and Al Pacino, the first time they met each other on screen. You know, they were both in Godfather Part Two, but of course, De Niro was in the flashback scenes in Godfather Part Two. So this was the first time in a big bit of movie history, De Niro and Pacino together in a film directed by a big name director, Michael Mann. But that's not the reason I like this movie. I like this movie because of the performance of Al Pacino, who is absolutely batshit insane during this entire film. In fact, when I was compiling this list, I came across an interview where Pacino said that his character in Heat was on cocaine the whole way. I mean, I believe that because he is he's mental in this film. And, a lot of film fans say, well, there's two Al Pacinos, basically the Al Pacino of the 70s, who was a kind of quiet, brooding actor who'd command the screen with his eyes and, you know, this intense emotional presence. And then there was the Al Pacino, basically from Scent of a Woman onwards, hoo-ha, that Al Pacino. And he's got another outrageous performance in The Devil's Advocate, which is a very fun film with Keanu Reeves in it. Not top 100 worthy, but worth a watch. But I would say the peak of shouty, insane, post Scent of a Woman Al Pacino is him in Heat. I mean, there's a scene right at the start where he just grabs, I think it's like woman is shacked with another guy or something, and he just grabs the television. He says, "This television is mine." And he just tries to like take the television. And then there's this, this scene here, she's got a great ass. mental. It's just so disconnect. Everybody else in the film is doing like quiet, you know, realism, and De Niro's doing his usual method actor stuff. Pacino, I don't know what he was doing in this film. Just off the scale, insane. And that is the reason to watch Heat, in my view. I mean, it's a good movie as well, but the real reason to see it is to, just to see Pacino unchained in the way that I'm talking about. All right. Yeah, you don't get to watch my television. Does he, like, throw it out the window? I can't remember. I think he just takes it with him, doesn't he? All right, so... Or if people are wondering, I do have an Excel spreadsheet and this PDF, which I'm going to share after the whole list is done. So tonight I'm going to get up, I'm aiming to get up to 41, and then tomorrow night I'm going to go from 40 to 1. Okay, this is what we're going to do. Number 92 is Titicut Follies, directed by Frederick Wiseman. Now, one of my favorite film genres. Is cinema verite. Now, people who don't know, cinema verite, or some people call it, what do they call it, direct cinema. It's basically a documentary style where you show people just, you know, in their everyday lives, with no voiceover, no talking head, no attempt at kind of narrative. Now, obviously, that, you know, it's been edited, and you know, you can maybe weave a narrative through the story, through the editing, but essentially you're just watching it. You know, it's the fly on the wall. You're just watching it play out with no other kind of editorial comment or narrative voice. And this guy Frederick Wiseman is the absolute master of this genre. He's got loads of these films, and if people are really like, you know, one of the things I really love is watching. You know, slightly grainy footage from the 50s, 60s, 70s, you know, just of everyday life. And Frederick Wiseman is the absolute treasure trove of that. He's got a film called High School. He's got a film called Welfare, which is just looking, you know, watching people on the welfare queues. He's made films, you know, it's just a lovely look at everyday life with no comment. You know, and that's the real thing. You're seeing just life close to, you know, as it really is, quote unquote, with just the perspective of the camera, I guess, and what he chooses to show you, I guess. You know, I guess there's an element that you can never get a truly kind of objective look, but this is as close as it gets, I think, in the medium of film. And Titicut Follies is especially notable because it's life inside a kind of mental asylum, essentially. These are all prisoners. You know, these are criminally insane people. This is essentially Arkham Asylum, the movie. And it's, you know, it's tragic. It's sad, funny in parts, but and really, really bleak, which is what I especially appreciate about it. So Titicut Follies, top recommendation from me. You'll see it crop up a lot on you know, most disturbing film ever lists, stuff like that. I don't know, disturbing, but it's certainly definitely worth a watch. And I kind of enjoy, when it comes to things like these cinema verite, I just kind of enjoy, like, kind of living in their world a little bit, you know, just looking at the furniture in the background, looking at the interiors, you know, just seeing what the world, you know, what the world was like. I love that sort of thing. And that's one of the reasons I love watching, Adam Curtis documentaries, because he shows so much of this kind of stock footage type stuff. But anyway, Frederick Wiseman, I've only picked the one film from him, but Titicut Follies, that's his most, probably the most famous one. But all of those other ones I mentioned too, definitely worth watching. If you're into that sort of thing, as I am. And a final one before I pause for super chats here, and that is number 91, Suspiria, the Dario Argento classic, horror. You know, horror fans are really into this film. One of the it's a lot of color, but the real thing that you have to talk about when you talk about this film is the soundtrack, the Goblin soundtrack, the very spooky, weird soundtrack.
as all the little hushed voices and things. Generally quite an unsettling experience to sit through. Suspiria, you know, the deep reds, the setup is that she, I think she goes and is it like a convent school or a, it's like a girl school, but a very kind of weird one, almost like a slightly culty one. And all sorts of strange things start happening to her when she arrives at this school. But it's, I would say, a film made by its soundtrack. So, yeah, it's a that's right. Concerto Cowboy, it's a dance school. So, let's pause here, and I'll have a look at some super chats, and then we will pick up where we left off. So, how am I going to do this? Right, I'm just going to go out into YouTube, and I'm going to have a look at the super chats, and then we'll keep on going. Let me know how you think the film, how the list is going so far. Are people enjoying the list of the, you know, I've given you 10 films so far. You know, if you've seen all of them, say 10-10. If you've seen like none of them, say 0-10. So let's have a look. Somebody has just given me $4.99, but the message has been deleted. Thanks for that, whoever you are. Jack says, if Goodfellas is on the list, AA is cancelled. All right. Well, keep an eye out. The Wooster says, now that Fuentes has fully endorsed Cat Boys, woo-woo, are they considered part of the greater right-wing tradition, AA? Is it right-wing approved debauchery? I'm afraid I don't know what Cat Boys is. I'm afraid. Is that the recent Cats movie? I have no idea. Yes. Actually, I did see that. Sorry. I did see that. I know what you mean now. I saw it on Twitter. I mean, I think the whole Groyper thing, it was a flash in the pan, wasn't it? Hinchster says, congratulations on the new baby. Amazing. And there I thought you were a queer. Bravo. No. Thank you very much. I can't say I've slept a lot, but other than that, it's been a joy. Chris Primer says, watch Double Down by Neil Breen. It will change your life. Okay, that's one I haven't seen. So there you go, recommendation from Chris Primer. Greed the Avaricious says, after your food pronouncements, here are mine. The 5 core items on any shopping list should be flour, pork, raisins, turnips, and leeks. This should then be accompanied by butter, lard, and sage. Well, the problem with that plan, Greed the Avaricious, is that how often do you really need to buy flour? Once you bought flour once, you're not going to need flour next week and the week after, are you? So there goes that idea. Sol Invictus, out of context, AA. I love this film because the visceral domestic abuse. Yep. Son of Tiamat says, are you sub to Rob Ager? His film analyses are a must. No, I haven't subbed to him. I don't know who he is, but I will check him out. I've got a friend called Sly Sneak who subs to a lot of film channels, so maybe I'll see if he's subbed to him. My Philosopher says, I'm guessing Bitter Moon will be on the list. Well, I'm afraid to say, Moif, you are not correct. Bitter Moon is not on the list, even though it is a very good film. So, with all that said, let us carry on. Where were we? So, number 90 is Punch Drunk Love, directed by Paul Thomas Anderson. And as I said on Twitter before I came here, there is one Adam Sandler film on the list, and it is Punch Drunk Love. Now, I'm a big fan of Paul Thomas Anderson. I think he's made a lot of excellent films. And this was the one that, you know, got a lot of people's attention. It was also probably the one movie where people said, oh, Adam Sandler, if he just chose his roles a bit better, could be a serious actor here. You know, he was hinting at possibly having that kind of slightly Jim Carrey, oh, is he going to do slightly more straight roles now? Never been better than he was in Punch Drunk Love. One of the things I love in Punch Drunk Love is that they, you know, set in this, let's say they're like car salesmen or something like this, but it's just set in this absolute hinterland of nothing.
And this is one of those things, you know, I've driven all around America. I've been from, you know, I did Route 66. I drove from Chicago all the way to LA. And I've seen all sorts of places in America in between, you know, towns you'd never visit, towns you'd never hear, you know, the Springfields of this world. You know, that was one of the things I realized that, you know, it's Springfield in The Simpsons, but actually like every state has got a Springfield. So I must have visited about 10 towns called Springfield, it seems like, especially in like the St. Louis, Missouri kind of area. But anyway, one of the things I found in my travels in America is that you get these vast miles and miles of what I came to call on the trip detritus. You've got, you know, it's not a town. It's not like a, you know, it's not like a town where you've got like a square and a, it's just like a kind of McDonald's, Starbucks, car lot, nothing, just nothing, just these weird units. And people, I don't know, like, I mean, I only stop for a burger once in a while in some of these places, but they're really odd. And one of the things I love about Punch Drunk Love is that it's set in one of these nowhere, it's just nowhere. It's just, they live nowhere. So that's one great thing about the film. I've pictured Philip Seymour Hoffman here. He's a very good actor, or was. He's dead now, isn't he? He's kind of got a lovely little villainous little character, kind of low. I love kind of low level villainy, and I think his character in Punch Drunk Love epitomizes that. So yeah, recommended if you haven't seen it. So let's keep on going. Number 89, another comedy, one from Britain, Robert Hamer's School for Scoundrels, starring Ian Carmichael and, of course, Terry Thomas. What a complete shah. Complete shah. Yeah, you're the cat and a bounder. Terry Thomas is an absolutely amazing, presence. And this film is awesome because it starts off with Ian Carmichael's character. He's sick of losing in life. You know, he's a loser. He doesn't get anywhere. You know, he's meant to be some sort of director at work, but his staff boss him around. He's basically a beta male in all ways. And he goes to this place called like the School of Life or Lifemanship or something. And they essentially teach him how to one up your rival in any given scenario. And it's a great film because obviously this Terry Thomas character has already been to this school, and he basically one-ups our hero in every single, you know, we follow this guy and he gets ripped off wherever he goes. You know, he gets lied to, he gets made to look like a cuck in front of this woman. Terry Thomas basically kind of steals his date, you know, beats him at tennis, or basically all of, like, he basically just humiliates this guy for the first half of the film. And then the second half is after he's like learned his lessons in the school, watching him get his own back on the Terry Thomas character with hilarious consequences. So School for Scoundrels, amazing film, highly recommended for anyone. And what I like about it as well, and you'll see this as a common theme, is it's unapologetic masculinity. You know, they just, it's so obvious that this is just what men are like, and this school. And, you know, there's a couple of little moralizing bits at the end, I suppose, but it's definitely recommended. Number 88, kind of a subversive film by Peter Greenaway, The Cook, the Thief, the Wife and Her Lover. This is like a Michael Gambon. He plays the thief. He's like this gangster. He owns this very gaudy restaurant. And it's kind of interesting because the whole restaurant is almost like in this kind of empty studio, and it's got this weird green, like blue lighting. But it's an interesting film. It's got scenes of absolute depravity in it, I would say. Clearly, this guy has got a lot of issues. I don't exactly know what it's trying to say. It's a very dark film. explores also, he's got hang-ups, he's got the sexual kind of perversions. She's obviously really unhappy with him. You know, she ends up sleeping with this other guy. And all the way through it, he's gorging on this kind of decadent, decaying feast of different things. And I mean, I don't want to tell you what happens. I don't want to give away spoilers, but there's a famous denouement, shall we say, that is not for the faint of heart. So let's keep on going. Another kind of an artier film, I would say, this one, but definitely kind of like a hidden gem. Sometimes the arty films are quite good. So number 87 is Whiplash from 2014. Now, anybody who watches this channel will know that I have said that there is bullying has some sort of social utility, and Whiplash is just a relentless. I mean, this guy, he's instructing this young chap here to play the drums, but he's basically a tyrant. He's basically a fascist. Just seeing seeing him grind down the young guy, seeing him the psychological breakdown of this of his mark, of his victim, if you want, is quite thrilling to watch, I would say. So Whiplash, one of the better films of the past decade, really, that I can remember. 2014, 2015 was really, that was, I would say, the after 2014, I can't remember too many great films. But Whiplash was probably one of the last times where really interesting films were being made, where I'd still bother to watch the Oscars, for example, because of a film like Whiplash potentially cropping up, you know. That doesn't seem to happen as much these days. So there we go. But yes, there's something visceral about watching the intense bullying in this film. So let's keep on going. Number 86, Warriors Come Out to Play. Now, I haven't got a clue what the Warriors is meant to be trying to say, if it's any good, if the film is just, I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous, to be honest, the Warriors. And this character in particular is, I mean, you've probably all seen the meme. You've probably, at least seen a clip of this. what I really like about the Warriors is that it reminds me of all of those, in the 80s, we played arcade games, and they'd often be set in like the slums of New York. One of the ones that I remember was Final Fight. You'd play Hagar, the mayor of New York, or his friend Guy or Cody, and you'd go through like beating up punks, and there'd be graffiti on the wall, and you'd go in the subway and pick up a chain or a pipe, the first Street Fighter film, the first Street Fighter game, for example. It also had this kind of Capcom in their films seemed to really in their games seemed to really like this idea of the kind of slum, the burning bin. You saw a lot of this stuff in 80s New York depictions. The Warrior is basically that as a film for however long it runs for. The whole thing is just that. It's almost like just watching Final Fight or something. So the Warriors, very good. Streets of Rage, that's another good one. Number 85 is The French Connection, William Friedkin, of course, more famous for directing The Exorcist, which I did not put on the list, but which is a great film as well, a really good film. Obviously, I just, I wanted to pick more interesting things. But The French Connection really is quite a surprising film, because of how into like the car chases you get, and it's just really, really well done. You know, the suspense, the chases, the sense of injustice, all of it. And Gene Hackman is great in the film as well. So French Connection, I would say one of the better thrillers ever made, to be honest. So it's just so good. And you know, you've all seen a minute, you know, you've seen the, like the new James Bonds and all the different, you know, all the special effects and stuff. This film shows you don't need really all of that. What you need is terse direction, and a sense of stakes. That's what you really need. And the French Connection, I would say, is just brilliant. It's probably the pinnacle of the chase movie, you know. So yes, and you get a lovely look at San Francisco as well, as it would have been in the early 70s before certain people ruined it. Let's keep on going. Number 84. Now, I was talking about 10 Willingdon Place as a serial killer movie that gets inside of a, you know, inside the mind of a sick killer. Probably the best film ever made for that. And the sense of the, how can I put it? The sense of the kind of detailed detective work and putting the viewer into the mind of the detective and trying to piece together the pieces yourself. Very few mysteries in history have really managed to do that. Probably the best example I can think of is the first season of The Killing. Did anyone see that? That Danish was it a Danish drama that was on? It was set in Copenhagen. She wore that sweater, and you know, for a while, like you know, loads of women were buying that sweater in honor of The Killing. But basically, that that was a TV show. Also got that, you know, what do you call it? Like police procedural. Getting inside an investigation, you feeling like you're part of the investigation, and also getting inside the mind of a sadistic person. Zodiac, I would say, is the best ever film for that. Now, David Fincher is an interesting guy because I've actually gone off a lot of his other films. Like I used to like Seven and Fight Club. Neither of them made the list on this occasion. Fight Club, I think, is a film that I was much more impressed with as a younger man, and now it's kind of seems a bit trite to me. Seems a bit obvious. And Seven now feels a bit gimmicky to me. Whereas Zodiac, on reflection, I reckon was David Fincher's best movie. So let's keep on going. Number 83 is On the Waterfront, directed by Ilya Kazan, starring Marlon Brando, of course. Now, what I like about this film is that it's it was a film. So, if you remember, Arthur Miller made wrote a play called The Crucible, in which he attacked Ilya Kazan and others for naming names when McCarthy drew up the blacklist, and they were naming Marxists in Hollywood, and this film essentially was Ilya Kazan's defense of what he had done, why he spoke up, why he named names, why he was willing to give the names of Marxists who were working in Hollywood. And Marlon Brando's character in this film is a kind of cipher for Kazan himself. So that's one reason that the film is really good, because it's a counter communist film. The other reason, of course, is because the performance of Brando is exceptional. It shows the corruption of the unions on the docks there. The union is basically overrun by the mafia in this film. You know, it's got the extraordinary, you know, I could have been a contender speech. Great, you know, On the Waterfront, all-time classic. And I kind of like the docks. You know, I mentioned before that when I was watching The Wire, I got to like season two and started to like question, you know, what should I be working on the docks? Is this a more authentic existence? I kind of like the kind of just incidental scenes of like people playing cards or people just working on the dockyard there. So On the Waterfront, fantastic movie. Number 83. Number 82 is Conspiracy,
This was a kind of a very talky film of a group of Nazis sitting around very coldly, dispassionately discussing how they're going to bring about the final solution. That is, how they're going to bring about the extermination of the Jews, obviously. I just love the, I love the fact that the film gets, you know, it takes a look, you know, in its own, it takes a look at what they call the mundanity of evil. You know, the, it, this is like just pure bureaucracy. It's watching the machine work itself out. It's watching how power operates. I kind of like the film for all those reasons, and it doesn't virtue signal at any point. You know, it's not. So like if you watch something like Schindler's List, you know, they lay on the schmaltz and the you know, the music, and you're meant to feel sorry at this bit, you're meant to cry at this bit. Conspiracy doesn't do any of that. You know, it's just played out completely dry. It starts, you watch them talk, then it ends. Fantastic. Fantastic kind of ensemble piece. So I love that. So let's, Conspiracy, great film. And then finally, number 81, before I get back to the super chats, is I had to put the Carry On films in here somewhere, and Carry On at Your Convenience is a film which shows all of the problems with unions, all of the little, set in a toilet factory. And they just show how difficult it is. And this character that I've pictured here, he's like one of the main kind of leftist agitators. I seem to remember that the Carry On, this particular Carry On was one of the few films that didn't make a return at the box office and, you know, caused a bit of controversy at the time because they went against the unions at a time where all of this was very topical. But I really respect it for that. So, there are some hilarious scenes in the film where, he's like, oh, no, you can't do that. That's somebody else's job. And you can't do that. That's somebody else's job. So in the end, like to, you know, screw on a pipe, you need four different people due to all of the regulations that are in place. It basically shows you all of the things that Henry Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson points out. So let's just have a quick look at Super Chats and then I'll get back to the list. JS says Zizek's favorite film is The Fountainhead by Anne, based on the Ayn Rand novel. Is it really? That's very interesting. I haven't actually seen The Fountainhead or read it. So the Wooster says, have you seen Uncut Gems, AA? It's another great reminder that Adam Sandler can act. I believe the film is still in the theaters. I have not. So maybe I'll go out to the cinema if I mean, doubtful given current circumstances, but possibly. And Moifer Velocitor says Day of the Jackal with Edward Fox. That is not on the list, I'm afraid. So let's, in the interest of time, I will carry on. Let's keep on going. Number 80 is Harry Brown. Now, this is a fantastic film, and for some people in the chat, it's a low-key reactionary film as well. It was praised by the Daily Mail, for example, here in the UK. And I think they said something like, finally, a film that really matters. And basically, it's this old white guy, Harry Brown, who has seen his local community go to rack and ruin, you know, first of all, it was a council estate, and then various immigrants have moved in, and there are drug dealers, and basically, like, everybody's a scumbag. And eventually Harry Brown, I think he gets beaten up or something by some youth, and he just snaps and he gets a shotgun and he goes kind of full Dirty Harry. I haven't put Death Wish or Dirty Harry on the list, even though they're famous kind of reactionary films, because I think Harry Brown, maybe it's because of the relocation to the gritty British setting, or Kane's performance, but I think Harry Brown
is the ultimate in that sort of movie. Okay. So, yes, I would strongly recommend Harry Brown. Now, I think Harry Brown would not get, you know, only 10 years ago, I'm not sure if Harry Brown would be made today. And I think Michael Caine had a lot of guts for starring in the movie, you know, bigger star as he was. And don't forget, he was doing like Batman films around this time. And in the middle of it all, he just starred in this kind of low-key, gritty, gritty revenge movie. So a vigilante movie, basically. So yeah, Harry Brown, a great, great hidden gem there for people. And I'm pretty sure The Guardian would have hated it. Number 79, Big Trouble in Little China. I watched this film a lot when I was a kid. Ton of fun. Again, you get to see you know, bits of San Francisco and things. John Carpenter, you know, famous for other movies like what did he do? The Thing, I want to say. Did he do American Werewolf in London? Was that him as well? Oh no, I always get confused between John Carpenter and John Landis. John Landis did American Werewolf, but anyway, one of the reasons to watch this film is for the performance of Kurt Russell, great underappreciated, insane 80s actor. Kurt Russell, he is just so. I mean, it's a pastiche of machismo. But it's a hilarious performance. The other reason to watch the film is for the villains. David Lopan, the kind of, he's like a kind of Shang Tsung figure, kind of an evil sorcerer. And then he's got these three lieutenants, you know, the three storms. I think one of them's called Thunder, one of them's called Lightning, and the other one's called Rain. You know, and you know, Lightning can do lightning. Storm can kind of puff himself up, and the Rain guy is like a swords, just a kind of finesse swords guy. I love that. I love the fact that they all look like Raiden from Mortal Kombat. And in fact, probably Mortal Kombat, I reckon, was low key based on the characters in Big Trouble in Little China. Great movie, and yeah, I've put it there. It's kind of a sentimental pick, but a ton of fun. Now, less fun is my 78th pick here, which is Dogville, the Lars von Trier film, which stars, of all people, Nicole Kidman in an unexpected film. And I think it's set in this kind of little town in, I want to say they're in Colorado, somewhere like that. And she gets involved with some like, gangsters and things. But one of the setups of the film is that there are no buildings. There are just these, you just see these kind of plots on the floor, on the so there are these different rooms. It's so dark, it's unreal, it's relentlessly dark. I love that, of course. So I a lot of people didn't like Dogville, a lot of people thought it was pretentious. I thought it was pretty good. I actually think it's aged well as well. So I love a bit of that. Now Lars von Trier has got a lot of other kind of sick twisted films, you know, Antichrist springs to mind. I haven't picked any of those. I did like Dogville though. I can see a lot of people don't like that, but still Dogville, especially if you want to challenge yourself a little bit. You need to challenge yourself, can't always be having fun. So speaking of darkness, number 77 it's a very unsettling horror film. I mean, I don't want to give away the ending, and I won't, but I would say it has some of the bleakest and darkest and most disturbing scenes in movie history. And one of the things I really like about Kill List is that it's got this incredibly claustrophobic, almost suffocating atmosphere from the start. You feel like you feel uneasy. And at the start of the film, nothing's happening. You're just watching people have a conversation. Maybe they muffle the sound a little bit. Maybe it feels like you're in a pressure cooker, and it builds as you go on. Incredibly effective film. And I was wondering what happened to this director, Ben Wheatley, but it just seems like he didn't really do anything else after this. But, Kill List was quite a disturbing film, and one that stayed with me since I watched it back in 2011. It's not the sort of film that you'd want to, I don't find myself wanting to watch it again, just because it's so dark. And especially right now, I wouldn't watch it at the moment because it would probably be too much for me. But it's just brutal, absolutely brutal. So let's keep on going, folks. So you can't all be darkness. So number 76, I've picked The Princess Bride. Fantastic film, kind of loving send up of the adventure, of the old fashioned fantasy adventure. These three characters here are absolutely fantastic. You know, there's Andre the Giant, of course, and chap in the middle, inconceivable, and the guy who's looking for revenge. You know, you killed my father. There's nothing else to say. One of the things people forget about The Princess Bride, of course, is that Columbo is in it, Randy. You know, the actor who plays Columbo, he's like the guy who's reading. He's reading a storybook. Just a fantastic film. And really probably like, you know, sometimes you talk about the best in class. Princess Bride, I would say, is the best film of that variety that I can think of. Nothing more to be said, really. Number 75. Now, one thing you'll notice about my list is that there's not a lot of films on it that I'd... that are kind of worthy or moralizing or kind of, you know, I dislike films that feel like they're clubbing over the head with a moral. I dislike, you know, it's virtue signaling. I don't like that. But 12 Angry Men, I wouldn't say it is kind of preachy in that way, but it does have quite an important lesson in it, which is the danger of confirmation bias. The 12 Angry Men are 12. One of them is absolutely convinced that the guy is guilty initially. All of them are. And over the course of the film, there's one guy who's like, no, let's study the evidence. Let's reason it out. Let's have a look at everything. The other guy's just driven purely by emotion. And I think it's just a lovely playing out of Daniel Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow or Jonathan Haidt's Righteous Mind. Over the course of a film. And because of that, there's a lot of great insights along the way in 12 Angry Men. So I think it's a film that's stood the test. I don't think it's necessarily, you think of Sidney Lumet as, maybe he's a slightly lefty director, social justice and all that stuff. But I think when it comes to 12 Angry Men, these are really principles that I think anybody, would want to, it's justice. It's true justice. It's what any of us would want. So yes, 12 Angry Men, very important and good film. And it's something that's probably needed to be shown more around the, remember when the whole Me Too thing was happening? It's a film like 12 Angry Men really is what you need to be showing to the film, remake it with women and maybe the feminists will watch it. Now, 74, another fantastic film. It's a martial arts movie. Probably the best martial arts you'll ever see anywhere is in this film, Ip Man. One of the reasons I really like this film is that it is unapologetically masculine. It is unapologetically traditional. It is unapologetically nationalist. It's all of these things. And it's a reminder of sometimes you don't need to subvert anything. You don't need to play it like this film plays it completely straight all the way through. Ip Man is just he's a uncomplicated, he just does the right thing. You can root for him. And the fights are amazing all the way through. So absolutely amazing film. Everybody needs to watch it at least once, if only to watch the combat sequences. But I dug the movie as well. It made me cry in a couple of places. I'd strongly recommend Ip Man. And number 73 is Love, Honor, and Obey from 2000. Now, there was a lot of these British gangster flicks that came out. Most of you guys will probably know the Guy Ritchie ones, you know, Snatch or, Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels was another one. But for me, the absolute best one of these sorts of films was Love, Honor, and Obey, starring Ray Winstone, Reese Evans, Jude Law, and a pile of other people. Really great film. And I was looking around for it to see, like, you don't hear this film too much these days. There's actually a version on YouTube. Somebody's just uploaded it, and for whatever reason, they've left it there. So you could watch this film right now if you wanted on YouTube. It's really funny. Ray Winstone is like a proper kind of stereotypical Cockney gangster. What I like about the film though is that it shows a number of dynamics that I really like. One is that there's genuine hierarchy in this gang. Like there's clearly Ray Winstone is the alpha. He's the big boss. And then there are kind of layers of kind of henchmen and things. There's a clear minion. There's a clear like absolute a mega male in the group who so that is one of the little dark things that explored in the film that I quite like. It's also about the nature of evil, like the motives that one of these guys is trying to get into the gang and he's trying to prove himself, but he's not in it for, you know, the other guys are in it for obviously, you know, for the crime and all the rest of it, but there's a kind of code. Whereas this one guy who's trying to get in, he's in it because he's just a sadist. He's sick. He's just evil inside. And I'm interested by that idea that some people are just sick. There's no reason. He hasn't been abused or anything. He chooses it. He chooses the evil because he's attracted to it. And I think that's a very interesting theme underexplored. The other reason to watch Love, Honor, Obey is that it's an absolutely hilarious film. It's really funny. There's one moment earlier on where Ray Winston's character is just like, "You're fat, I'll throw you in the river." So there's a lot of that sort of stuff. Yeah, you're a mug, mate. All of that sort of stuff. So I would strongly recommend watching Love, Honor, Obey, especially if you like gangster films and you haven't seen it, because it's. For me, it's better than the Guy Ritchie movies. I think this was I don't know why people don't talk about it more. It was easily the best of that kind of crop of British gangster films around the turn of the century. 72. Speaking of the mundanity of evil, is The King of Kong, hilarious documentary from 2007 about the world of 80s arcade game world records. And there's this guy called Steve Weeb who wants to set the Donkey Kong world record. But the current record holder is this chap that you're seeing here, Billy Mitchell, who set the original record back in the 80s. And what is amazing about the film is that it's like I don't know if it's an editing or I don't really care, to be honest. This guy is just like a heel. He's just a villain, basically, who pulls out all the stops to try to stop our man Steve Weeb from beating his record. And what is amazing about the film is just the level of like the state on the nerds in this world of arcade game world records. And the depths of, like, this guy, Billy Mitchell, he's got all these little minions who do his bidding for him. And he's genuinely like a kind of moustache twirling villain. It's amazing. I really love The King of Kong. Every once in a while, it's one of those films I'll just stick on once in a while just for a laugh. Amazing film. So, yep, King of Kong. And Billy Mitchell's up there with the top villains of all time for me. It's just the low level. I was talking about Punch Drug Love, about the low level villainy, just the absolute low stakes villainy of Billy Mitchell. It's just amazing. 71, another P.T. Anderson film, Magnolia, starring
lots of people, Tom Cruise probably in his best ever role, you know, respect the cock, tame the, I won't say it because the stream will get demonetized. As the food one, and if anybody watched the food stream, that got demonetized because Binary Surfer said the C word. So Magnolia, really interesting film. I love the Amy Mann soundtrack, which is going to make, it's probably going to be very cringy for a lot of people, but I think the songs on the Amy Mann soundtrack are really good. It's got really strange shifts of tone. And what I love about Magnolia is that, you know, it explores what, like 9, 10, 11 different characters, and they're all just broken. They're all just dead and broken inside in various different ways. And I love it. I love the, I love to see the exploration of the misery and the reasons that all of these people are miserable. One of my favorite actors is in there, William H. Macy. You know, he's there's a film he was in once called The Cooler about a guy who's so like got such bad luck, he sent in the casinos to like cool winning streaks and things like that. But anyway, William H. Macy in this film, and he plays like seem to remember his character was somebody who used to be really good at quiz games when he was little, won a lot of TV quiz shows, but now he's lost it and he's just like just nothing. Philip Seymour Hoffman's in the film. There's a cop. What's the name of that actor? I really like Magnolia. Now, a lot of people say it's a little bit too long. It's a little bit overblown. It's possibly a bit pretentious. Yes, to all of those things. You know, there are frogs. But I actually like what it's trying to do. You know, the character studies that you get in the film are worth watching. And it's just worth watching for Tom Cruise's storyline alone. So let's keep on going. Now, you know, regular viewers to this channel may not like me picking a film from the Soviet Union, but I've decided to go with Man with a Movie Camera from 1929. I think one of the oldest films on the list. But if you haven't seen this, this is, I mean, the setup of this film, there's a man, he's got a movie camera, and he wants to just see everyday life in Russia, basically. There's so much vibrance and vitality in the way that it's edited, in the way that it's cut, in just and all you're watching is kind of, you know, people getting on the train or people just going about their life. It's a great film, despite the fact it was made in the Soviet Union. Really, one of the best films ever made, I would say. Amazing visuals, just absolutely sensational. I want to say there's a movie that there's a version of it where they've kind of redone the soundtrack a little bit. And I think that's the one to track down. I can't remember the name of the soundtrack, but there's an alternative soundtrack version, and that's the one that I would recommend watching if you can. So, Man with a Movie Camera, fantastic film. Number 68, another one of these. It's probably the film that started, you know, that whole trend of the Guy Ritchie movie off is Trainspotting. Just a fantastic film. So much fun. So many memorable scenes. You know, banging soundtrack. A look at like really, really kind of scummy area of Scotland. You know, Begbie, just a memorable character. I mean, I don't know what else I could say about Trainspotting. You know, disturbing look at drug culture, I suppose. Just a great film. And I would say captured the zeitgeist of the mid 90s quite well. You know, time capsule movie of Britain in the 90s, too. So Trainspotting, absolutely still worth watching, still a lot of fun. Now, I never bothered to go and watch the sequel. I don't know if anybody did watch the sequel. I know Trainspotting 2 came out recently. I'd be interested to see what it was like, but I dug Trainspotting quite a lot. So number 67, another really dark comedy by Alexander Payne, same director who did Sideways, is about Schmidt. And I think this is one of Jack Nicholson's more unheralded roles. You know, people always talk about like, what's the best Jack Nicholson acting performance. He is so good in about Schmidt playing this old man. The setup of the film is that as it starts, Schmidt here is retiring. You know, he's retiring after a long career, given the watch and given a send off by his company, and then he goes home and realizes that the wife, you know, this wife, like, you know, he's basically like without his job, he's got nothing. And I think his wife dies as well, and then he really does have nothing. So you're watching this guy trying to cope with retirement, and then he's also like looking back and thinking, what have I done? What have I done with my life? And I've done nothing. I've achieved nothing. It was devastating watching this film in the cinema. I remember because I watched it with a lot of people in the cinema were old people. They were clearly people who were either retiring or have already retired. And this was so on the nose. It was so kind of it was dark. It really was. People were clearly crying in the cinema because of how close to the bone this was. But anyway, he ends up getting like a big, what do they call them? UVs. Like he goes on a road trip essentially and ends up having like getting in a jacuzzi with Kathy Burke, I seem to remember. Not Kathy Burke, what's her name? But anyway, about Schmidt, I would say a very underrated film, quite an effective, affecting movie as well. Now around this time, Jack Nicholson, I didn't put it on the list, but it's another kind of hidden Jack Nicholson film. He did another film, I'm trying to remember the name of it now, which is also worth digging out, where he's surprisingly good. Another good old, you know, Jack Nicholson when he's old type performance. I'm trying to remember the name of it now. I'm not thinking of The Departed. It was there's a church in it. Unfortunately, it's not. Let me just have a quick look to see what the name of that movie is, because that's worth watching as well. I'll just dig it out. Now that I'm talking about it, I could have easily put this on. He's really good in terms of endearment in the early 80s. But the film I'm thinking of is The Pledge. That's it. The Pledge. I remember that was the other really interesting film he made around this time. Definitely worth a watch. Okay, so let's carry on. Because number 66, to the shock and horror of everybody in the entire chat, is Star Wars Episode 3, Revenge of the Sith. Now, what is this film doing here above some of the amazing films I've already picked? Why? Well, folks, the truth is that I am a massive fan of Emperor Palpatine. And I've also always, I've had this dream. Ever since I can remember, my dream film was a film which essentially we watched the forces of evil and darkness take over the universe, and that's it. And the closest film ever to that vision is Revenge of the Sith. It is a film where the bad guys win. The bad guys win in the film. The Emperor ends the film basically taking over the entire galaxy. It's amazing. It goes to dark places. And that's why, you know, they're, you know, and not just the women, the children. Execute Order 66. There are so many memorable things in Revenge of the Sith. Now, yes, it's part of this, it's not a great film. And, you know, Mr. Plinkett and Red Letter Media and all the rest of it. But for the things I'm looking for, it's got a magnificent over-the-top Palpatine performance. You know, the whole You Were the Chosen One stuff is kind of epic and pretty good. But it's the reason it's here for me is because it's a film where you just watch the bad guys win and take over. And I don't think another film like that has ever been made. So for that reason alone, Revenge of the Sith. And I can reveal, folks, no other Star Wars film has made the top 100. And this is one of those interesting things, because if I was to list how I'd rank the Star Wars films, I obviously wouldn't say Revenge of the Sith is the best Star Wars film, because it's not. But in terms of my personal favorite movies, it's right here at number 66. So Revenge of the Sith. Think of the moments. Unlimited power. Number 65 is Performance. Very odd film directed by Nicholas Roeg. Now, it's famous for having Mick Jagger in it and many scenes of kind of debauchery and drugs. You know, there's a lot of kind of hippiness in the film. But I love it for this chap here, the guy with the glasses. And he's like this kind of London Jewish gangster. I just love the gang in Performance. And it's kind of, it's almost like watching a dream sometimes. It's such a strange film. And it's almost, it's got that kind of fish lens. And you're not sure if this guy's is this real? Is this guy a cartoon? The Performance is amazing. I went to see Performance in a special screening once in Richmond upon Thames in the Riverside Arts cinema, and the group of people I was with, they did not like the movie, and they walked out in the middle of it. You know, everybody walked out of the film, much to my horror. Because I wanted to watch the end of it. So for a long time, I didn't watch all of Performance because everybody walked out agreeing that they thought it was awful. I think it's a really interesting film. Not just for the awesomeness of this gang. I mean, that's the main reason, but also for the stuff with Mick Jagger and all the rest of it. So now many people will know Nicholas Roeg for the horror film Don't Look Now. I'm actually a bit of a contrarian on that. I don't see what the fuss is about with that movie. I actively dislike it. I dislike the milky kind of sex scenes in Don't Look Now, which makes me a pariah in certain horror kind of, I was never popular in horror film circles for my, because I dissed Don't Look Now. And I also dissed Night of the Hunter. I didn't like those two films, and I thought they were much better horror films. Back in the long history of horror, but for some people always talk about those ones. I'm not a fan of it. I am a fan of Performance, however. So there's another Nicholas Roeg movie worth mentioning. We are starring David Bowie, which is not on the list as well. That's The Man Who Fell to Earth. That's definitely worth a watch too. Number 64 is Zulu, I've got a friend called the Britisher who really loves this movie. And I can imagine many people in the chat love this film as well. Just a great war film. One of the great things about it is that the assumptions of this Michael Caine actually plays against type. He plays a posh character. He's kind of a bit superior and smug, and he's comes from the officer class. He's brought in to command this unit. And it's the ultimate film of theory versus practice. Caine has got all this kind of theory in his head, but experience and on the ground reality is what matter. And that's the thing that he learns during the course of it. There is also an interesting kind of pacifist, kind of leftist priest in the film as well, who tries to persuade them not to fight. Zulu, I mean, it's class. What can I really say that hasn't been said about it? Just a great film, high stakes, great drama, all the rest of it. Another war film at number 63, and the first entry from Stanley Kubrick is Full Metal Jacket. Now, there are lots of reasons to like this film. You'd love the smell of napalm in the morning and all the rest of it. Vietnam, for me, the best part of the film, as you've guessed it, is the training camp. It's the bullying. It's the grinding down of the fat kid there, and the I love the way that Kubrick's camera just, it doesn't look away. He never looks away. That's what I love about Kubrick. He's just so, you know, where you'd look away, he just keeps the camera. And that's really why I put Full Metal Jacket here. I don't see Full Metal Jacket crop up on these lists as much as some of Kubrick's other films. I think it's pretty good, obviously, because I've put it here. So, it's the whole private pile sequence. That's what I really like. I just think it's, it's that whole whiplash thing again. And this drill sergeant here, he's obviously, I find it fascinating to watch such a process go on. Number 62 is another one of these Cinema Verite documentaries. This one is Salesman by the Maisels brothers. Now, Salesman is a fantastic film. It follows a group of salesmen who are trying to sell these deluxe Bibles. And it just follows them around. It's so desperate. It's so, the one that you're seeing here, you can just feel the desperation on him and the underlying bitterness in him. And this is what draws me to this film. There are some, they get interviewed throughout the film and they're trying to explain what goes on. It's amazing watching these salesmen, you know, the ones who don't make the sale, try to like BS their way out of it. And they're trying to they're trying to keep face to each other. And you can see that some of them are really struggling. And just the little kind of rivalries that develop and the jealousies. Salesman. So good. It's such a good film. And again, just watches. Doesn't comment. Number 61 is Todd Browning's Freaks. Not a film for the faint of heart. And a film which famously many people thought ended Todd Browning's career. Of course, famously, he directed the original Dracula, you know, the one starring Bela Lugosi. But a much better, much more interesting film is Freaks. Now, aside from the fact that you see all of these people working in this, it's set around a circus, a traveling sideshow, and the people in the film are genuine, quote unquote, freaks. They're sideshow attractions, people with all sorts of unusual deformities and ailments, and it's really quite harrowing. I mean, it's like you're watching these people. These were clearly real people. Like this one I've pictured here, you know, they were clearly people who made their living in these sideshows. And one of the interesting things about Todd Browning is I think he grew up in and around the circus. So he was aware of this very weird carnival world of the circus. There's a woman I seem to recall in Freaks who's she wants to kind of exploit she sees herself above all of the freaks, and then they teach her a very nasty lesson. I don't want to give away what happens in the film, it was banned at the time, famously caused an outrage. I think it was banned in Britain for about 30, 40 years. They reassessed it in the 60s. I'd be interested to know what the social justice cry would make of Freaks today, because it's. But again, I like it because it doesn't look away, gets into kind of interesting areas, like for example, how the sideshow and the circus actually gave these people like a lease of life. It gave them something useful to do. It gave them an opportunity to like make money from their predicament, if you want to put it that way. But there are some very sinister thing that goes on in Freaks. It's I designated it as a horror film, but it's really kind of in a category on its own. I can't think of any other films like it. So number 61, Freaks. Everybody must watch Freaks at least once. Let me pause for the super chats. Dylan 98 says, has the Joker, or OUATIH made the list. I can exclusively reveal, Dylan, that one of those films has made the list. And Charlemagne says, The Usual Suspect and Primal Fear are better movies where the bad guy wins. Yeah, come on. Come on. Maybe. But are they as fun? Are they as fun? No, because neither of those films have Palpatine in them, do they, Charlemagne? So let's keep on going. Number 60, as Britisher predicted, David Bowie has made an appearance on the list in Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, a film set in and around a World War II prisoner of war camp in Japan, where Bowie here is the commanding officer on the British side, and they've got this this commanding officer on the Japanese side, and he's like a samurai. He lives by the code of the samurais, very honorable guy. And he kind of has a grudging respect for the Bowie character. But he wants to try to break him, because that's the he's trying to break his spirit, and he can't. And you can see in this scene here that, you know, he's buried Bowie up to his neck in sand, and it's a really interesting duel of wits, a kind of strange thing where they're fascinated with each other, they respect each other, but they hate each other. And I really like films that look at like two characters' duel of wills in this way. And Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence is very interesting for that. It's interesting, rather. It's kind of a weird film. It's kind of dreamlike sequences, and you go back to like Bowie's childhood and all this sort of stuff. Great, great little hidden movie. Nobody really talks about it much. I never see it crop up on lists or anything. I've always enjoyed it. There's a really interesting, another interesting Japanese character in the film, who's the prison guard, and the interactions between Bowie's character and this prison guard are also like well worth. And that's where the title comes from, because he keeps on trying to say to him, Merry Christmas, Mr. La, Miss Ars, you know. So let's keep on going. Number 59 is This Is England. One of my favorite directors, Shane Meadows, and this guy in the middle here, Stephen Graham, is a fantastic actor, of course. This Is England's really interesting. This kid gets involved with this group of skinheads. They're in the National Front. You know, they're nationalists. They're racist, essentially. Just a very interesting exploration of that. One of the real things that is good about This Is England is that it doesn't necessarily preach about, you know, it's not saying, oh, well, you know, racism is sick and wrong and evil, and aren't these people horrible? It's actually trying to understand them from the inside out, and like what makes a man like Stephen Graham tick and all the rest of it. Really, really worth a watch. I dig This Is England. There was follow-ups, weren't there? There was a TV series and all the rest of it. I watched a few of those, but I can't remember. I remember them being pretty good, but I haven't got round to finishing up on that. I still rate This Is England quite highly. And spoilers alert, this is not the only Shane Meadows film on the list. I would recommend people just go and watch all of Shane Meadows' films, especially if they want to get into British, like recent British cinema worth watching. He's one of our best directors, to be honest. So there's another really good one called the one with Bob Hoskins in it, where he opens like a boxing thing. What's it called, that film? What's the Bob Hoskins boxing one called? Anyone? 24/7, is it? 24. Sorry about this. I'm just trying to remember the name of this movie, because people should go and watch it. 24/7, that was it. Definitely worth watching as well. As is another film I haven't put on the list, A Room for Romeo Brass. Disturbing film. As is Summer's Town. I mean, Shea Meadows, everything he's made is worth watching, really. So number 58 is Taxi Driver, especially interesting film to watch today in 2020. Really quite a reactionary film, quite kind of this guy, he's sick of seeing like the filth and the degeneracy around him, you know, basically wants to clean up the streets, takes it upon himself. Interesting film, very interesting film, great performance by De Niro. Now, Scorsese, one thing I will say about Taxi Driver is that it's quite slow. You know what I'm saying about like slow pondering shots and things? Scorsese really does kind of linger, but I kind of like it in Taxi Driver. I like what it's lingering on. And it's low-key getting at some pretty reactionary themes, I would say. I'd be interested to see somebody like Black Pilled. Or even maybe Morgoth review Taxi Driver today. That would be something. That'd be something interesting to see. One of Scorsese's best. Number 57. Another Ray Winstone vehicle. His first one, Scum, directed by Alan Clark. There's actually two versions of this. There's one they made for TV in 1977, and there's this one. I prefer the second one because it is more violent, more brutal, more extreme, if you want to put it that way. He lives, you know, it's life in this Borstal, like young offenders institution. Brutality and violence, just great, probably the best prison film ever made, I would say, probably. Ray Winston's a really good actor. He crops up a number of times in this. He's just great. He's just great in these sorts of roles. So Scum, absolutely stone cold classic. There at 57. Number 56 is Downfall. Now, what I like about Downfall, it's not just the famous, you know, that one speech of his has been endlessly memed and parodied now, but it's a tremendous film. One of the things I really like about Downfall, not only is it a German film about Nazism, which is interesting in itself, but it's the mood of Berlin on the eve of the total loss. It's the fact that people have started to dance on the table. They get to this moment where the only thing left to do is laugh. You know, things are that bad. Really interesting film. So. Yeah, I don't know if people still talk about Downfall, but I just think it's probably one of the better films made in the last decade, of the previous decade. A great central performance by what's his name, Bruno Ganz, I want to say his name is. I highly rate Downfall. Recommend watching it if you haven't seen it. Now 55. Is another great Scorsese film. I watched this film in the Barbican in London. In fact, I've seen this film twice in London. I watched it once in the Barbican and once beamed onto the side of Battersea Power Station outside. It was like an early date I went on with Mrs. AA, one of these special events they do sometimes in London. But anyway, when I went to see it in the Barbican, the entire audience were pissing themselves laughing throughout the entire movie. One of the funniest films. It's so funny. I don't know if you're meant to be laughing or not, but I found it absolutely hilarious. And I still, whenever I've watched it since, I find it really entertaining. So The Wolf on Wall Street, just a fantastic movie. And this scene, of course, is where they're throwing this dwarf at a target. It was one of the films where you start to think maybe Leonardo DiCaprio, you know, after Titanic and Romeo and Juliet and all of that, you know, he was like a pinup in the 90s. He's become a very decent actor, I would say. And he can carry a film like this. Just tremendous. The scenes where they're taking the drugs, just the excessiveness of it all. yeah, really interesting film, and just supremely entertaining. Probably the funniest film on this list, to be honest. Number 54 is a comedy, and that's Kind Hearts and Coronets, another Robert Hamer classic Ealing comedy. The setup here is that this guy that you're seeing, he wants to inherit the family fortune, the family estate. The unfortunate thing for him is that there are 8 other family members in his way. So he hatches a plan to coldly kill all of the family in front of him. And all of the family members are played by Alec Guinness. What's brilliant about Kind Hearts and Coronets is the sheer Englishness of it, the poshness of this central performance by what's his name, Dennis Price. Alec Guinness is tons of fun. There's a great scene at the end. You know, it is clear that you are insane. I mean, it's a great film, one of my absolute favorites. Yes, just the if people are into their Englishness and their Britishness and so on, Kind Hearts and Coronets, I reckon, maybe the ultimate. It's fantastic. Number 53 is The Birthday Party, another William Friedkin film. This is a adaptation of Harold Pinter's play of the same name. Now, it's a really interesting play and an interesting film, because these two gentlemen that you're seeing on the right, the Jewish chap Goldberg and the Irish chap McCann, the guy on the left is called Stanley, and these two men basically, they visit, and we don't know who they are, and they basically just kind of prey on this guy Stanley, and we don't know why they're there. And they're trying to break him down, and they bully him, and they kind of mentally torture this guy, and we don't know why, and it's very menacing. The Birthday Party, a very interesting, maybe it's a metaphor for what society does to us all or something, I don't know. But I strongly recommend the Friedkin version. I think he directs it very well, and I love the performance of the three central guys here. That actor in the back, you'll recognize him. He's in Clockwork Orange as well, and number of, what's his name again? Patrick something? I always forget the guy's name. Patrick McGee. Yeah, I mean, whenever Patrick McGee crops up in a film, it's usually worth watching. It's usually going to be a bit dark and sinister. Definitely worth watching. And this again, it's a bit of an under the radar one. I don't know why more people don't talk about it, but I find it is kind of menacing. All sorts of dark things go on. So number 52, on a slightly lighter note, is Disney's Alice in Wonderland. Now, I will note that I've tended to note directors all the way through this. Walt Disney did not direct Alice in Wonderland; he was the producer. In most of the Disney films are directed by about 10 people, like unit directors and various different animators and things. So it's just easier to put Walt Disney. So that's why I put Disney there. I very highly rate the Disney Alice in Wonderland. It's probably the best film version of it. Gets across the weirdness of the whole thing. It's dreamlike. It's strange. The depictions of the March Hare and the Caterpillar and the Mad Hatter and the Talking Roses and the Doorknob and the Dodo and, you know, the Queen of Hearts and all the rest of it, the Cheshire Cat, all absolutely iconic. Never to be bettered in my view. And one of Disney's best. I don't know how, I know my friend Rose of Dawn is like a Disney aficionado. I don't know how people tend to rate Alice in Wonderland in the Disney canon, but for me, it's right up there with one of their very best works. Number 51, of course, is the classic horror film, The Wicker Man, from 1973. Now, again, this is a film that does things that few other films do. One of the things I'm really interested in it is that it's got a central character that we don't really care for. Like I always watch this film and I think maybe I want him to die. Maybe we just like the members of this cult want our man to be burnt, in the Wicker Man. Maybe we become part of them. That's the kind of scary thing that Wicker Man plays with. It's also just obviously great performances all around. Christopher Lee, I had to get him in something. He's in Revenge of the Sith as well, of course, but probably one of the better Christopher Lee roles as well. He's just superb as the leader of the cult. So yeah, Wicker Man, absolutely recommended. Let's dash through the next 10 and then we'll start wrapping this up. Number 50 is Groundhog Day. I really rate Bill Murray. I like him a lot. Great in everything, basically. Very good in Lost in Translation. And there's a hidden one called Broken Flowers, where he's just kind of trying to revisit old girlfriends that he's had. And there's something about that Bill Murray character, you know, especially the older kind of more kind of dead behind the eyes Bill Murray character. But for me, the absolute best of all of his works is Groundhog Day. It explores some really interesting themes, some great set pieces which are really funny. The idea of living the same day again and again, lots of kind of high concept. And it's kind of quite funny for most of us that it was directed by Egon Spengler. So there we go. Groundhog Day, absolute classic. Probably one of the better kind of mainstream comedies ever made that I can think of. 49 is another Scorsese film, The King of Comedy. Now, obviously, lots of people have been talking about The Joker recently. I actually think The King of Comedy explores those themes in a more interesting way. It's a bleak film in many ways. You know, the sad interior of this guy, Rupert Pupkin. You know what drives a man like this. The scenes where he's playing to just a completely empty room are, I think, quite they're weird, they're unsettling to watch. Yeah, so for me, one of Scorsese's absolute best. And if Scorsese's racking up some appearances in this list, isn't he? But a very good Robert De Niro performance. See, Robert De Niro, I guess, is the ultimate in you don't have to like the person, because obviously recently he's become like a real lolcow idiot recently, isn't he, in his political stuff. But you can't deny the body of work that he has. And King of Comedy is definitely one of his career, one of the best parts of his career. Now, number 48 is John Wick. Now, some people may think this is a very high rating for John Wick, but I think it's what can I say? I was blown away when I saw John Wick. First of all, when I saw it in the cinema, it took me completely by surprise. It's a perfect action film, from start to finish. It takes what they were doing in The Raid, and it kind of brought it to a kind of, and it's so slick and it's cool, and it doesn't apologize for itself. The plot is done and dusted in about 5 minutes at the start. Oh yeah, you know, personal stuff, here's a picture, bang, let's go. Completely rewrote the rules, I think, of the modern action film. And it's just, again, another film where it's see, this is the interesting thing where they, you know, people complain about, oh, they're going to capture James Bond and they're ruining Star Wars and there are no more male heroes and all the rest of it. What about John Wick? I mean, John Wick, at a time when traditional masculine heroes were, you know, starting to be ruined by social justice people, John Wick comes along and, well, here's a brand new one. Yeah, take that. So, yeah, I just think John Wick is a tremendous movie. Number 47, the newest film on this list by a mile, is Once Upon a Time in Hollywood by Quentin Tarantino. Really interesting film, especially in light of what I was just talking about, traditional masculine heroes, a sense that, you know, white men are losing, a sense that white men are losing their culture, losing the things they love, losing their grip on power. And Tarantino just makes this love letter to Hollywood. And, of course, the villains in the movie are the kind of Manson crowd, this group of social justice warriors who are dealt with in the most hilarious Tarantino-ish ways possible. I love this film. I mean, it goes on quite a long time, but you're just kind of watching, you know, Brad Pitt just be a Chad around the place and not apologize for it. And I don't know, there's something amazing about it's kind of not in a hurry. It's just not in a hurry, and it just luxuriates in its own kind of juices. And I like that. The whole sequence where we watch the DiCaprio character, you know, he's this struggling actor and he's playing in a Western. I loved all those scenes as well, where we just kind of watch them on set and stuff. Yeah, probably Tarantino's best film in 20 years or something. Longer. Number 46 is 2001, A Space Odyssey, another Kubrick classic. Last time I watched this film, I actually went to a BFI event in London with Mrs. AA, and we watched it with a live orchestra. And I am now convinced that is the way to watch 2001 with a live orchestra in a cinema, with an actual kind of opera, you know, a kind of a choir and a full orchestra. When thus spake Zarathustra, you know, was getting going at the start, the hairs on my arms were standing up. It was just amazing. But aside from that, this is another film where you can just get lost kind of looking at the incidental kind of background, the furniture, the set design, and it asks some really interesting questions about humanity and what it's all about. And of course, Hal is one of the great movie villains of all time, isn't he? So, 2001, obviously a classic. Number 45 is Fritz Lang's Metropolis. Another film strongly recommended. Metropolis is, I would say, you know, probably the best sci-fi film ever made. It's got some crazy scenes, a gorgeous kind of German... what do they call that? German, what's it called? That school. It's really good though. It's one of, if you haven't seen Metropolis, you definitely need to do it once. I love the kind of, the sets, the kind of mechanized world that we're watching. You know, you can see the German idealism, and the, you know, meshing with this kind of sense of modernity. You know, are we happy about it? I don't know. It's just it's a very interesting film to watch. So Metropolis, stone cold classic. Number 44 is kind of a little known British Dennis Potter screenplay, Blue Remembered Hills. Relentlessly dark. One of the interesting things about it is that it's about a group of children, but all of the child roles are being played by adults. So it's adults playing children. And yes, there is bullying, friends. Yes, there are scenes of relentless darkness. It is disturbing, and it is absolutely worth watching. When I first watched Blue Remembered Hills, I was probably a teenager, stay with me for days, weeks on end. And every once in a while, I think maybe I'll dig out Blue Remembered Hills. Very good, very good. Disturbing work. 43, another Scorsese film, Goodfellas. Somebody said they're going to unsub if Goodfellas isn't on the list. Well, here it is. Probably one of the best Scorsese films. You know, it's an epic. It's really captures the sense of what these gangsters are like. Cool moments, you know, insane violence, moments of closeness, great acting. It's got everything, really. I don't want to linger too much on Goodfellas because I feel like some of these films have been talked about so much. But if you haven't seen Goodfellas yet, sort your life out. Number 42 is Eraserhead by David Lynch. Speaking of disturbing films that will stay with you for days on end, what about Eraserhead? I mean, it's where can I start? This would be another film that I'd be interested to see a Black-pilled or a Morgoth or somebody like that take on, because I think a lot of the things that those guys talk about, these low-key reactionary revolts against the modern world type things, well, Eraserhead is like a nightmare. This guy is obviously feels trapped by modernity. He feels trapped by living in this world where everything seems dead and slightly unreal and nightmarish around him. And then the radiator starts singing and there's a woman in there and there's an alien baby and what the hell's going on? So, it's like a fever. The whole film is like a fever dream. But to me, it's one of David Lynch. I mean, I don't think I've put any other. David Lynch is a very interesting filmmaker that everybody, Elephant Man is obviously a disturbing film. Blue Velvet is an absolute classic as well. But I feel like Eraserhead doesn't get put on these lists enough. And I feel myself drawn to this one more than some of the more ponderous later films that other people go on about. I like Eraserhead. I think it's got, I think it kind of gets under the skin and keeps you like wondering and thinking, And then you find yourself walking in the concrete jungle yourself and thinking, maybe I'm feeling like this guy. And finally for tonight, before I wrap up, we did quite well. Look, it's only 10 past two. We got there, folks. We did it in 2 hours. It's Walt Disney's Pinocchio, which not only is an absolutely gorgeous film, famously Disney spent. It's one of the most expensive films ever made, I think, because they went over every single scene like dozens of times. If you just watch and like the backgrounds, you see the shadows and the flickers of the candles, and there's such attention to detail in every single shot and frame of Pinocchio. But not only that, Pinocchio is relentlessly dark. I mean, look at Pleasure Island. It's a tale of this young, naive guy who's kind of groomed by this weird fox and sold into slavery. Like he's sold into slavery, the Stromboli character, and then the coachman is. I mean, and then the Pleasure Island is this. All of these kids who are smoking and drinking and up to no, they're basically delinquents, and they get. It's Pinocchio for me, probably I think the best. I mean, both in terms of my personal favorite, but also in terms of aesthetic quality kind of interesting content. Probably the best of the animated Disney films. I think by quite a distance. Snow White gets a lot of plaudits because it was the first one, but Pinocchio was the one I think Disney like put everything into it. All his heart and soul, everything. And, a lot of people say, oh, well, Walt Disney was a Nazi and he was anti-union. Or for me, Walt Disney was a great artist. Forget about what has happened to his company since. The man himself was a visionary and a genius, in my view. And that is where we're going to end tonight with 41. If you try to go on, the rest of them are blank. Look, just in case I made the rest of them blank. So tomorrow night, I will do 40 to number one. I hope people have enjoyed this. You've got a lot of films to watch if you haven't seen them. If anybody's watched all 60 of those movies I mentioned tonight, then kudos to you. You know, every once in a while, people surprise me. Couple of super chats. Mikey Sweet has said, "I know you're British and an intellectual, but you've said the word film 10,000 times. Throw in a movie here and there for fun." Well, the thing is, when you're speaking off the top of your head, it just comes. You know, I tend to say film. You know, in my mind, a movie is more of like a kind of popcorn. It's more like a popcorn flick. I always think movie is like a kind of, you know, your Avengers Assemble, whereas a film is something more artistic. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but Charlemagne says, "Did you see the Korean John Wick, The Man from Nowhere?" No, I haven't seen that. Maybe I should check it out. So yes, let me know what you made of this, folks. Hopefully, people learnt a good bit. Let me know what you think. Hopefully you'll have found something. I mean, when you're doing these lists, people are always going to disagree with you and they're going to be outraged what's been left in and what's been left out. But hopefully this was worth doing. And I'll see you tomorrow night. Now get out.